Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Nahum chapter 3, which I will entitle Woe to Nineveh. Nahum is a prophet about whom nothing is known, except that he was from an unknown place called Elkosh. We do know that he prophesied between 663 and 612 for reasons I detailed in chapter 1. And of course, the object of his short three-chapter prophecy was the city of Nineveh. So we begin now in Nahum 3, verses 1 through 7. Woe to the city of blood, totally deceitful, full of plunder, never without prey, the crack of the whip and rumble of the wheel, galloping horse and jolting chariot, charging horsemen, flashing sword, shining spear, heaps of slain, mounds of corpses, dead bodies without end. They stumble over their dead. Because of the continual prostitution of the prostitute, the attractive mistress of sorcery, who betrays nations by her prostitution and clans by her witchcraft, I am against you. This is, of course, talking about Nineveh. This is the declaration of the Lord of hosts. I will lift up your skirts over your face and display your nakedness to nations, your shame to kingdoms. I will throw filth on you and treat you with contempt. I will make a spectacle of you. Then all who see you will recoil from you, saying, Nineveh is devastated. Who will show sympathy to her? Where can I find anyone to comfort her? Where can I find anyone to comfort you? Now, those first seven verses are easy to understand. It's great rhetoric, poetic even, talking about the destruction of Nineveh. I'll make a few comments. Verse 4 says, because of the continual prostitution of the prostitute, a commentator on Nahum I found on the internet named Pet says this, she, Nineveh, had offered occult practices, sexual perversion, false religion, political favor, and indecent wealth in a poor and struggling world. And she had offered pleasure beyond telling, and people had flocked to her, and had been degraded, and had become like her. Now in verse 5, Yahweh says he's going to lift up the skirts of Nineveh. Now, of course, this is a poetic allusion to a woman who would be taken into a public square and have her skirt lifted over her head to show her lady parts, which is pretty disgusting, pretty degrading. Pitt says the idea is of a disgraced and worn-out prostitute. We go down to Nahum chapter 3, verses 8 through 9. Nahum speaking in the voice of Yahweh, are you better than Thebes that sat along the Nile with water surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea, the river her wall? Cush and Egypt were her endless source of strength. Put and Libya were among her allies. So we have a little digression here in two verses about the famous Egyptian city of Thebes, which is still there, a great tourist spot, which unfortunately I didn't get to because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Why is Thebes mentioned? Because Thebes, which is also known as Noamon, was a very famous city. Let me read you what Barnes says of Thebes. Thebes was far famed, even in the time of Homer, for its continually accruing wealth, its military power, its 20,000 chariots, its vast dimensions attested by its 100 gates. Again, Barnes says, the prophet's appeal to Nineveh is the more striking because No, which is Noamon, which is Thebes, in its situation, its commerce, the sources of its wealth, its relation to the country which lay between them, had been another and earlier Nineveh. Only as No had formerly conquered and exacted tribute from all these nations, even to Nineveh itself, so now under Sargon and Sennacherib, Nineveh had reversed all those successes and displaced the empire of Egypt by its own and taken No itself. So, since Assyria had beaten Thebes, 663, Nineveh might be pardoned for thinking they were better than Thebes. But God asked, are you better than Thebes? And of course, that's a rhetorical question expecting, no, you're not better than Thebes. Are you in a safer condition than Thebes? No, you're not. As the Cambridge commentary put it, should Nineveh expect a happier fate than Noamon, than Thebes? No, it should not. Thebes was powerful, all right. Nahum says it sat along the Nile with water surrounding her. That's because the city lay on both sides of the Nile, but was girt about with arms or canals of the river, as the Cambridge commentary says. So she was safe because she had all that water protecting her. Her rampart, of course, is a defensive embankment. Her rampart was the sea. Now, the sea there is not a sea, it's the river Nile. As the Cambridge commentator says, a large river or any mass of water is called sea. So that's the sea. The river, her wall, that would be the Nile River. So she's protected by water. And then in verse 9, Nahum mentions some sources of strength for Thebes, namely Cush, which is Ethiopia, which is to the south of Egypt. Egypt herself, of course, was the strength of Thebes. And then Put, which is to the west of the mouth of the Nile on the Mediterranean Sea. Libya is Libya, the Lubim, other translations have it. Put and Libya were among her allies. Now, there's a problem here because it sounds like Put and Libya are two different places, where if you take Put as Libya, which most people do, as Wikipedia puts it, Put has been consistently identified with Libya, and I do too, just for the sake of simplicity, because I don't know. I found another gentleman named Patterson that says perhaps Put is the fabled land of Punt in coastal Somaliland, which Somalia, that's south of Egypt also. But I'm going to say that Put is Libya. Why Put and Libya were among her allies, if they're the same place? Cambridge commentary says here Put and Libyans seem distinguished. Yes, they do. The place of Put is usually sought on the north coast of Africa, west of Egypt, though the views of scholars are divergent. But the Cambridge commentary doesn't say anything more than that. I had an idea that maybe the Lubim that's mentioned in other translations, maybe they're the Libyans, and so the meaning would be Put and the people who live there, the Libyans. I don't know if that's reasonable or not, because I don't know Hebrew that well. I don't know it at all, actually. So we go now to Nahum chapter 3, verses 10 through 14. Yet she became an exile. Talking about Thebes now. She went into captivity. That happened in 663. Her children were also dashed to pieces at the head of every street. They cast lots for her dignitaries, and all her nobles were bound in chains. You also will become drunk. In other words, you're going to go down just like Thebes went down. You will hide yourself. You also will seek refuge from the enemy. All your fortresses are fig trees with figs that ripened first. When shaken, they fall right into the mouth of the eater. Look, your troops are like women among you. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire will devour the bars of your gates. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your fortresses. Step into the clay and shred the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. Verse 10 says, yet she became an exile, talking about Thebes. Yet means despite all of her fabulous wealth, she nonetheless became an exile, and that was done by Assyria herself in 663. Let me read you another description of the wealth of Thebes. This is from the Cambridge commentary. Noamon, that's Thebes, was celebrated in antiquity as Thebes of the Hundred Gates. It possessed a famous library and was filled with temples and other buildings of extraordinary magnificence. Its riches were fabulous. Compare the statements of Assurbanipal regarding the wealth his armies carried away when they captured it. The splendid ruins of Karnak and Luxor attest the former magnificence of the city. Karnak and Luxor are still tourist attractions today. The Temple of Karnak is astounding. It's the biggest and ugliest ancient temple you'll ever see in your life. But at any rate, despite all of her riches, her children were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. That was what the Assyrians did to people. The Assyrians cast lots for Thebes' dignitaries so they could be sold into slaves. I get this one, you get that one. And all her nobles were bound in chains because they were sold into slavery. 11, you also will become drunk. You also will become drunk. That's talking about the Assyrians now. Trying to drown their sorrows when they are attacked by the Medes and the Babylonians. The city of Nineveh is attacked by the Medes and the Babylonians. You will hide yourself, trying to run away from the Medes and the Babylonians when they break through the wall. You also will seek refuge from the enemy. All your fortresses are fig trees with figs that ripened first. Well, a fig tree that has a ripe fig on it, first ripe fig, those figs are going to fall off. When you shake the tree, they'll fall off. Easy pickings right into your mouth if you want to eat the figs. And that is the point of the analogy. The fortresses are going to fall very easily. Verse 13, look, your troops are like women among you. These women are not the Amazons who want to participate in men's wrestling now because we don't know the difference between a man and a woman in early 21st century America. Nope. The women here are referred to as weak women, and your soldiers are like women, and they're not going to be able to protect you. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire will devour the bars of your gates. Of course, the bars are what are put across the gates to keep the gates from being opened, but if fire burns up the door, it's going to burn up the bars, and then the enemy can walk through. draw water for the siege, that would be from the Tigris River. And of course, a besieged city always has trouble with its water supply. And so the Assyrians are told to draw water to get ready for the siege. It took 3 years for the troops of the Medes and Babylonians to knock off Nineveh. Strengthen your fortresses, step into the clay and tread the mortar and take hold of the brick mold. Now, this is a little bit difficult to understand. Let me read from the God's Word translation here, verse 14. Store water for the siege, strengthen your defenses, step into the clay pits and trample the clay. Now, that makes a lot more sense. Grab the brick mold. So the idea is you have to prepare clay to make bricks. The clay has to be mixed with straw or coarse grass to keep the bricks from falling apart. And so you have to have a pit of clay that's wet, muddy-like, and then you pour in the straw and the coarse grass, and then you tread on that wet clay in order to mix the straw or coarse grass in with the clay. And then you grab the brick mold so that you can put the clay into the brick mold to make a brick. You then dry the bricks in the sun, and then you put the bricks in the wall to build up the fortifications to withstand the siege. It's not going to do any good because eventually Nineveh is going to go down. We go now to Nahum 3, verses 15 through 19, and we will finish this chapter and the book. The fire will devour you there. The sword will cut you down. It will devour you like the young locust. Multiply yourselves like the young locust. Multiply like the swarming locust. You have made your merchants more numerous than the stars of the sky. The young locust strips the land and flies away. Your court officials are like the swarming locust, and your scribes like clouds of locust, which settle on the walls on a cold day. When the sun rises, they take off, and no one knows where they are. King of Assyria, your shepherds slumber, your officers sleep. Your people are scattered across the mountains with no one to gather them together. There is no remedy for your injury. Your wound is severe. All who hear the news about you will clap their hands because of you, for who has not experienced your constant cruelty? In verse 15, Nahum says that fire will devour the Ninevites, the sword will cut the Ninevites down, and then Nahum says the sword will devour you Ninevites like the young locust. And so if you can picture, like in the book of Joel, a swarm of locusts who come and they eat everything in sight and strip everything bare. And then I think what he does is he switches the metaphor of locust, the referent of the word locust from the Babylonians, to the Assyrians themselves. Multiply yourselves like the young locust, multiply like the swarming locust, two different kinds of locust. There are lots of kinds of locust in the Hebrew. And what Nahum is saying is, you Assyrians have multiplied everywhere. You've made your merchants more numerous than the stars of the sky, and then you strip the land and fly away, talking about how the Assyrian merchants had flocked into Nineveh when Assyria was prosperous to make their money. But they're going to disappear as fast as locusts when the judgment comes. So the merchants come into Nineveh. The court officials are there. They're like the swarming locusts, the government officials from the equivalent of the IRS. They're scribes like clouds of locusts which settle on the walls on a cold day. But when the sun rises, they take off. No one knows where they are. That's what locusts do. And that's what's going to happen to all these merchants who are flocking into Nineveh. When the siege begins, they're going to take off. And then in verse 18, Nahum says, King of Assyria, your shepherds slumber, your officers sleep. Normally, shepherds and officers are caretakers, but not now in the time of judgment. They are asleep on the job. Your people are scattered across the mountains with no one to gather them together. They're all running. They're not staying there to defend the city. They're scared. There's no remedy for your injury. Verse 19, your wound is severe. All who hear the news about you will clap their hands. Now, why is everybody going to be shouting for joy and clapping their hands when Assyria goes down, when Nineveh goes down, which is basically Assyria? Why will all the surrounding nations be happy? For they had experienced the constant cruelty of Assyria. Assyria was well known for its cruelty, its barbarous tortures, its burning cities to the ground and so forth, its depopulation of the inhabitants of a conquered city. And so everybody's going to be happy. And on that happy note, it's happy if you believe in judgment for evil people. Assyria is gone. Nineveh is gone. And we have finished the book of Nahum. That prepares us to go to our next audio, where we will begin the study of Habakkuk. So I hope you stay with me as we embark on that enterprise, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.